talk was given on the occasion of the Hanford Monthly Speaker Meeting held in Hanford, California on February the 5th, 1977. The original recording of this talk was made by Don Russell of Fresno, California. A copy of that original recording was provided courtesy of Harry Hansen of San Joaquin, California, and this cassette was produced from that copy by Bill and Diana Cross of Ash Tree Fellowship Tapes, located at 4588 North Meridian, Fresno, California, 93726. Phone number 209-229-8244. Members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's tradition number 11 regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in their use of this tape. The total playing time for this recording will be 61 minutes. Side A will be 45 minutes, and side B will be approximately 16 minutes.
Thank you. Everyone, my name is Dick Heaton, and I'm an alcoholic. Delighted to be back here again. Always delighted to be back any place, and most of you feel the same way. AA is really wonderful, you know. You not only have your anonymity, you even have your aliases. Now, poor old Vic is known as Red, Serenity Jim. You know, we've all got them. I'm better known as George McKenzie, so help me, than I am by my true name. That's one that I'm still getting mail in some of them. I spent a lot of time in penal institutions, and this is a very distinguished-looking group. Jim said I was a distinguished character, and I am. I'm a sober alcoholic. Most of you are, too. It's fascinating to me that we can be so much like human beings and so different from about 9/10 of the population who drinks. We in Alcoholics Anonymous get to feel comfortable in an AA meeting where we don't feel comfortable anyplace else. And the real reason is that this is where we are. This is the only place where we alcoholics outnumber the alcoholics, or the non-alcoholics. Roughly it's 9-1 if you drink. And here the chances are that the alcoholics are in a vast majority, whereas if you stopped 100 people on the street, there would only be 10 of us who'd be alcoholic and the other 90 would be non-alcoholic. We resist this as long as we can. We don't want to think we're different from anybody else. But the real joy of our life comes from the fact that after a while, we realize that in the things that are important to us, we are indeed different from the non-alcoholics. I'll touch upon that later. I suppose the grapevine has told you my profession. If it hasn't, well, I probably want to admit it. As I say, I spend a lot of time in institutional work. I go to penal institutions and mental institutions. And the last penal institution I went to, they didn't identify me until it was too late. And after the meeting, somebody said, you won't know who spoke to you, but I will tell you that when he's working, he wears a robe, and he isn't a priest. So with that sort of a background and the distinction that was distinguished, by which I was distinguished here, and because one of my dear friends in Hanford insists that I tell this story wherever I go to put you misdemeanants and felons at your ease, I'll tell it. I understand that there are a lot of alcoholics who've had a lot of contact with the law and that they didn't find it wholly satisfactory in all circumstances. So here we go. This is the story that will put you at your ease. There was a sweet, kindly southern judge, the way we all are, and he had before him a large black defendant, and they were no strangers. Seymour had been before him practically every Monday morning of their respective lives. And this time he looked over the bench and he says, Seymour, he said, this time it isn't just the ordinary Saturday night beef. He said, this time you're in real trouble. You beat that guy up pretty bad. He may not even live. He says, this isn't just drunken disorderly. This isn't drunk in public. This is something. He says, have you got anything to say by way of mitigation? He said, mitigation, Judge? He said, what's mitigation? Well, he said, excuse. Have you got anything to say by way of excuse? Did he say anything to provoke you? He say, provoke me? He called me a big black son of a bitch. What would you do if somebody called you a big black son of a bitch? The judge says, well, I'm not a big black son of a bitch. Seymour says, yeah, but suppose he calls you the kind of a son of a bitch you is. Now, so much for the spiritual approach. We alcoholics know that it doesn't make any difference what kind of a son of a bitch you is. Whether you're black or white or fat or thin or tall or short or young or old or high or low on the social scale or in or out or otherwise mentally ill or suffering from some other disease, none of these things makes the slightest difference to us alcoholics because we're alike in the things that are important, the two common denominators of our disease. And as I have promised, I will touch on that later. You know, if I suppose that my spiritual progress, if it can be called that, in Alcoholics Anonymous, could be illustrated by what happened to me. A lot of you have had the same experience. Small towns are particularly difficult in one way and easy in another for the alcoholic. At the end of my long geographic cure, I went everywhere. I'd been drunk in every state in the United States except Florida. And up until that time, I'd never been in Florida. I wound up in Ventura, and I took an office over a bar, the way God intended, and I spent more time in the bar than I did in the office. And I was a conspicuous drunk. You're conspicuous in a small town if you come out of that bar at 5:15 in the afternoon and the streets are full of the walkers going home and so forth. And if you don't always come out vertically, that you're noticed. They say, oh, you know, there goes that drunken Dick Heaton again. There were a couple of them that thought I have ought to have my own gurney, but I really didn't come out that often on that plane. But there were two little old ladies in particular, you know, they used to say, there goes that drunken Dick Heaton again. Well, after you get sober, you're equally conspicuous because they say, well, what happened to him? What happened to him? What happened to him? Well, everybody who knows anything knows that what happened to him was AA happened to him. So my two little old ladies, instead of saying, there goes that drunken Dick Heaton, began to say, there goes Mr. Heaton, the alcoholic. And then later, as fortune and God smiled on me, they began to say, there goes His Honor, the presiding judge of the Superior Court, lecturer and consultant on alcoholism. So I'm going to lay a lecture on you. I'm going to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Now, that is a very presumptuous thing to do, and I wouldn't do it except that I have been encouraged in it by some people who ought to know better. I was asked, and frequently asked, and still am, to explain to people in various study groups, seminars, service clubs, universities, schools of other kinds, what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And of course, this is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. Most of us who are alcoholics or who are, when somebody asks us, what is Alcoholics Anonymous, if he's an alcoholic, why, we don't bother to say what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Look, I can't explain it to you, but I'll show you. Come with me, and I'll show you what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And this is really the only way to find out. But upon these demands to be told what Alcoholics Anonymous is, I came across a pamphlet that had been put out by our General Service Office in New York, and it's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of you may have read it. It was a transcript of a talk that was given by one of our old friends in Southern California named Al McGee, who during his lifetime, and he died sober after many years of in the program, was asked to make a similar kind of a talk. He was asked to talk to, I think it was the University at Riverside, to a bunch of people who were going to be parole officers and social workers and probation officers and family counselors and people who ought to know something about alcoholism and ought to know something about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he made this talk, and I borrowed freely from it, so freely, in fact, that he probably wouldn't recognize it, and you won't either if you read it. But if you find a copy and want to see the pure gold of truth, read that. As I say, I wouldn't feel right if I didn't at least give him credit not only for the inspiration but for some of the points that I'm going to make in explaining what Alcoholics Anonymous is and how it differs from all of the other programs for the diagnosis and treatment of alcoholism that we have ever known in history or that we now know. Alcoholics Anonymous is a very peculiar institution, organization, fellowship, phenomenon. There's nothing quite like it in the whole world. I think the only positive definition of it that I know is the one that's read here and was read tonight. It goes something like this, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. Now, so far as I know, this is the only positive statement of what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Then, of course, the definition goes on in the modern tradition to say what Alcoholics Anonymous is not. And, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous is not anything else except the fellowship of men and women. We don't have any dues or fees or membership roles or officers. We're not allied with any denomination or sect. We don't wish to engage in any controversy. That may come as a surprise to some of you. We don't get involved in politics. We just ain't nothing but a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. And here the operative word is share. Because until Alcoholics Anonymous came along, there had never been any undertaking on the part of anybody to share among alcoholics or with alcoholics as equals anything in the nature of our recovery. The reason for the current interest in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's very widespread now, is that if you want to know anything about the recovery from our seemingly hopeless disease of mind and body, if you want to know anything about it, you've got to know something about Alcoholics Anonymous. Because here is the place that people recover from this hopeless disease of mind and body. And they don't recover anywhere else in any substantial numbers, any comparable numbers. I'm told that we have conservatively now in the world not fewer than 1 million sober alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous. In 92 countries, in 26 or 7,000 groups all over the world, just like us, just like we are here. And, of course, if you are interested in sobriety in the alcoholic, you must see what we are, what we have, and how, indeed, we do differ from the methods and programs of diagnosis and treatment of our disease that exist, usually without anything in the nature of a comparable success. I don't say this in a spirit of doing more than inviting everyone to the attractiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't promote. There's no reason for us to. Every living, sober alcoholic has confirmed in his experience exactly the things that all of us confirm in our experience, and that were first confirmed in the experiences of the first 100 alcoholics in history who'd stayed sober, and who put their wisdom, their deduction, as to the character and nature of the disease, to the method of the treatment, and to the persistence of the necessity for persisting in the program, the intense interest in spiritual progress, all of these things that constitute the wisdom that's found in our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the most astonishing things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that in its 40 years, there are more sober alcoholics than there ever have been in history. More than that, there were probably none before Alcoholics Anonymous came along. Prior to AA, it was standard operating procedure for every alcoholic to go mad and die. Almost nobody got well. There were almost no exceptions. Occasionally, there would be somebody who'd make ecclesiastical or psychiatric or medical history by recovering by some miracle. But by and large, it was indeed a hopeless disease, and there was nothing that could be done about it except, as alcoholics from the beginning of mankind, so far as our recorded history goes, went mad and died. And then along about, what was it, 1934 or 5, along in there, Alcoholics Anonymous probably had its beginnings, and we can probably see some of its definition in how it had its beginnings. When you'll remember that Bill Wilson was in Akron and had had a rather disappointing, if not disastrous, business experience, and was on his way through the hotel lobby, and he himself didn't know whether he was on the way to take a drink or on the way to do something else, but he knew he had to talk to another alcoholic, and he saw in the church directory in the lobby of the hotel, I think it was Mrs. Firestone, anyway, by a series of contacts, he was put in touch with Dr. Bob, who was widely known throughout Akron as a hopeless, dead-end, lost drunk with no chance of recovery. And the two were put together, and for the first time in history, we have one alcoholic seeking out another for the purpose of staying sober. Always before, alcoholics had sought each other for the reason you and I sought each other out. We were less conspicuous when we drank than when we were out with a bunch of amateurs. But on this occasion, Bill got together with Bob, and as it is today, one-to-one, across the coffee table, a sharing of the experience of one who had had some slight experience of sobriety with one who had had none at all. But here is the first instance in history where we have a true sharing between one alcoholic and another of the experience, strength, and hope that is what we do today. Always before, you know, there'd never been a sharing as equals. This was the first time a sharing as equal. And that's what AA is now. It's the most dramatic thing about Alcoholics Anonymous when you come is that you are welcomed as an equal. You are invited to come in and share what we have. And you don't have to accept the invitation. Many people don't. You don't have to accept it right away. You can accept it many, many times. It's always there, and it's always to come in and share what we have as equals. Because if you're like us, you need what we have, and if you need what we have, here's where you can find it. And it's part of our love to give to you the opportunity to share with us, just as it's part of our recovery to share our love with you. Now, this was unique, and probably still is, in the history of the diagnosis and treatment of alcoholism. Astonishing, perhaps, that nobody ever thought of this before, but nobody ever had. Always before, there was a feeling of authority on the part of the sober non-alcoholic who would look down on the alcoholic and say, you worm, if you don't do what I tell you, something terrible is going to happen to you, and I'm going to see that it happens to you. They would say, well, the spouse might do it. The spouse might sit and say, my father doesn't drink. My mother doesn't drink. My brother doesn't drink. I don't drink, but you drink, you worm. And if you don't knock it off, I'm going to go home to mother. Or I won't, as the case may be. The kindly old judges used to do this, too. They had a book. They said, I got a book here that says that your conduct violates the statute therein provided. And it says here that I can do something terrible to you if you don't quit drinking. So you quit. And if you don't quit, I will do something terrible to you. And they did. But without any effect, because we knew all this, but you can't command an alcoholic. You can't command a cancer patient. You can't command a diabetic. You can't demand a polio patient to stop suffering from his disease or you'll hurt him. Yeah, you know, that's silly. The clergymen used to do this, too. They used to have a book. They'd say, I got a book. It says in my book that you're a sinner. And it says that if you don't knock off that sinning, something terrible is going to happen to you. And I'm going to give you a very vivid description of what it is, you know. And then they'd give us a picture of hell. Well, we'd been there. They didn't know what they were talking about. But they said, if you don't stop this, you're going to go to hell. Well, you know, we went. All very often done in the kindest of spirits, often done with compassion, often done with great urgency, but never successfully, because A disease doesn't yield to that kind of treatment. And you cannot tell us, alcoholics, to do something that's beyond human power. You just can't, and it doesn't work. So that here now in Alcoholics Anonymous, for the first time in history, we have a sharing as equals. Nobody's bigger than anybody. I'm reminded of the story that they had in the Reader's Digest a few years ago about the clubhouse that the kids had. On the wall they had a sign, "Nobody act big, nobody act small, everybody act medium." And of course this is what we are. We are alike. And because we are alike, we share as equals. And there is no authority of any kind in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have one over the other. And the great joy and comfort that we have is our sharing. Well, then the first distinction between Alcoholics Anonymous and any other program of diagnosis and treatment of our disease comes from the fact that we do indeed treat each other as equals. The Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that one is invited to share without compulsion. Of course, there's a lot of fuss around the circles that I move in now because there are those of us who will send people to Alcoholics Anonymous or else. The thing has come full circle now, and I'm happy to report that both the judges and the lawyers are now being subjected to disciplinary measures, where in the Judicial Council for one and the Disciplinary Board of the State Bar for another, they say, "You go or else." And a lot of us are going, and it's a delight. How you square that with the invitation of Alcoholics Anonymous is very easy. All I do is get them to the door and you invite them in. Or I invite them in, as the case may be, if I happen to be there. But then we're equals. Then you come in and share as an equal. And it's an astonishing thing that so many people coming in rebellious, coming to the door rebellious, find that indeed this is what we need, is a sharing. Well, that's the first distinction. The second one is I've touched upon and promised that I would touch on more, and that is that we in Alcoholics Anonymous treat alcoholism as a disease. Now, you'll say everybody knows alcoholism as a disease. We've known that for years, ever since AA, certainly, and before that, probably. Everybody now concedes it is. The AMA has said it was a disease for years. AA won the Lasker Award, which is a medical award. There isn't anybody that would quarrel at all with the statement now that alcoholism is a disease. The only trouble is that nobody cares. Nobody believes it. Nobody knows what it means. If they know what it means, then they're in Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it's almost incredible that in this day and age, people will still say to me, "Oh, I know alcoholism is a disease, but why don't you use your willpower? I know alcoholism is a disease, but why don't you quit drinking and cure it?" You know, it's insane, but it exists. One of the most significant things about our program is the emphasis that we put upon our disease. And some of you may know that a lot of this arose in my interests in scientific things from my close association with one of my fellow alcoholics named Willard B. from Santa Paula. Willard B. and I were in 1952 voted the most unlikely drunks in all of Ventura County to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Willard was captured about that time and taken over to the state hospital. And while he was over there, he achieved his sobriety and humility on the garbage truck. And it took him 91 days. They used to put you in for 91 days then. And during his 91 days, he got sober and I got sober. Because when he went in, we were both drunk. And when he came out, we were both sober. So he's a kindly fellow. He lets me share his birthday. I have the only 91-day-long birthday in AA, besides his. And he also lets me share his number. For those of you who are likewise graduates, I'm 30,756 and a half at the Camarillo State Hospital. Well, anyway, when Willard went to the hospital, he was a perfectly normal alcoholic. He was either drunk or getting drunk or getting over being drunk or on his way to getting drunk or sick because he was drunk or sick because he wasn't drunk or laying in a supply or drinking for his supply or fighting for his supply climbing trees naked before non-alcoholics did that. He was a busy fellow, and he obviously had no time to be concerned as to why he drank. But when he got over to the hospital, he fell under the auspices of this Austrian refugee psychiatrist who used to look at him and say, "Mr. B, why do you drink? Why do you drink?" And Mr. B got to thinking, "Why do I drink?" And it damn near drove him crazy. So when he got out, we embarked upon a study of the scientific literature in connection with alcoholism that we are pursuing to this day. It's very easy now, because if you get the grapevine, you know, you turn over the back and read all those little gray pages. They've got everything that's going on inside and outside the world of alcoholism, whether it's inside or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they've got some weird notions in there. They put down at the bottom, you know, something to the effect that these views do not necessarily reflect those of the management. But they've got a lot of these scientific abstracts in there, and they're saving me and Willard a lot of time now because we don't have to do our own initial research. Parenthetically, however, I must share with you something that came across my desk last week. I occasionally fall afoul of psychiatric reports having to do with drunks. And this, I think, is just a dandy, and I do want you to hear it. If you recognize yourself in this, I'll explain what you are like. He is prone to impulse behavior when his psychological restraint is adulterated with ethanol-containing beverages. Now, I explained to this alcoholic, to this psychiatrist when he sobered up, that what this really means is that a drunk is unpredictable, and I could have told him that. What I mean is that all scientific knowledge about alcoholism is neither knowledge nor scientific. And it's an area in which one of my academic friends says we are particularly prone to the academic admonition that no one is inhibited by ignorance from expressing an opinion. Now, we get a lot of them about alcoholism, and as a consequence, my statements concerning our disease will be an oversimplification. And if there are any of you who are genuinely men and women of science, if you are MDs or pathologists or biochemists or psychiatrists or psychologists or RNs or nurses' aides, or if you really have got the background to prove your scientific knowledge, then please forgive what I have to say, but remember it. The disease of alcoholism is best described to this day, I think, in our chapter 3. It wasn't read here tonight, but many of you will remember it. It starts right out by saying something like this, that most of us were unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. And then it went on to say why. It said no one likes to think that he is bodily and mentally different from his fellow. And that's what's the matter with us. We are bodily on the one hand and mentally on the other, different from the kind of people who can drink and not get into the kind of trouble that we got into. Now, at this point, I should probably say I know there are a number of non-alcoholics here. Some friends from Al-Anon, my friends from Al-Anon are here. And I do want to say that no alcoholic that I know, and least of all I we would have to express a great deal of gratitude to the non-alcoholics in our lives, because there's none of us who comes to this program without the offices of one or more or many non-alcoholics. Now, some of the things you did to us were not exactly what we liked at the time. Some of you did them with compassion and tenderness, and some of them did them the way most of you did them. Whatever you did, you were contributed to the horror that led us into Alcoholics Anonymous. And now, having paid you that glowing tribute, I will leave you, because I don't know anything about you. You are, especially your drinking habits, you're the most peculiar people I ever saw in my life. I have seen you take one lousy martini and drink it for an hour and 15 minutes. 2 ounces. Wring out the pimento and slice the olive. It's a pastime, not a drink. I wouldn't get my mouth dirty for a martini. You're the kind of people who'll go and set a drink down and go away and leave it, and then not even know where it was, and if you don't know where it was, you don't care until somebody like me comes along and drinks it, you know. Weird drinking patterns, wholly inexplicable to me, and probably mine is inexplicable to you. But mine's the one that's important to me, and yours isn't important to anybody. Nobody cares how you drink. If you don't want to, you don't want to. You know, that's a giveaway in itself. But anyway, we alcoholics are different. We have a twofold disease. All through our literature, we get this twofold thing. As I mentioned before, we have a seemingly hopeless disease of mind and body. No one likes to think he is bodily on the one hand and mentally on the other, different from his fellows. We have something that's in the nature of an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. Always these two things. And you can get pretty fancy as you explore this, and you can use a lot of semantic dodges to explore it. But to get right down to earth on what's the matter with us, on the one hand, physical side, we're hooked. We're addicts. We're the kind of people who, when we have a drink, have to give the drink a drink. When we take a drink, we light the fuse and nothing can stop us from the bomb going off. And it's, in the present state of scientific knowledge, incurable, progressive, and terminal. There's nothing you can do about it at all once you have this bodily quirk. The necessity, you know, you're hooked. That's all. It's as simple as that. On the mental side, not to put too fine a point on it, we're nuts. We're the kind of people who know that a drink will kill us. We deny that we will ever drink again. We do it while we have it in our hand. We toss it off. We say we haven't had a drink. We pass quietly out. And when we come to, we're mad at you because you didn't believe us. Now, there's some mental aberration involved there somewhere, but it's a standard operating procedure for us. We believe it. You know, that's what makes it insane. If we didn't believe it, if it was a real con job, then we would just be a little weird. But as it is, we're completely nuts. Many is the time we've been told by our doctors, you know, you've got cirrhosis of the liver and cancer of the trachea and half a dozen kidney ailments and gallbladder trouble, and you could be completely well in 3 weeks if you just quit drinking. And we say, certainly, doc, that's exactly right. And then we go out and get drunk. So that means that the physical side isn't all of it, because on the mental side, we kill ourselves against our will. Now, you can't be any nuttier than that. These two things together constitute the disease. You can have either one alone without having the other, and then you're not really an alcoholic. You can be an addict. You can be hooked. You can, some of us are still addicted to tobacco cigarettes, for example. But we've got enough marbles so that it doesn't really affect the situation. And if we had to, we could quit. And we keep telling ourselves that, and some of us really do. But I knew a lot of hard drinkers like that. I used to be in the oil business, and I knew a lot of guys that could drink a fifth of whiskey a day and shake their head and go to work. Of course, I could drink a fifth of whiskey and shake my head and it'd come off. But these characters really were not nuts. They just had a bad habit. And when the chips were really down, and when Mama said, "Look, Pop, you're spending $100 a week for booze, and we could have two new automobiles and put Junior through college for that," he said, "Yeah, you know, you're right. It's going to be tough, but I'll quit." And he quit. And he did quit. He could do it because he was not mentally ill. He was merely had an addiction. Now, most of us aren't like that. Most of us have the mental illness, and some of us don't have the addiction. I suppose 95% of my friends, whether they're alcoholic or not, are a little off base. Up here, you know, they do some awfully peculiar things, and they hold some peculiar notions. They hold a lot of the notions that I used to hold. They have the frustrations and the lack of achievement and the feeling of guilt and a few things, but rather minor compared to ours in the Alcoholics Anonymous, who are alcoholics. But they're all right because they're not hooked. They live their lives of quiet desperation. But they're not conspicuous enough to be in the kind of horror and pain that compelled them to do anything about it. And that's probably a lot of our friends are like that, and they're not hooked. You get the two of these things together, though, and you have the vicious circle of alcoholism. On the one hand, you're compelled to drink, and on the other hand, you can't cope with life, so that the more you drink, the less you can cope, the less you can cope, the more you drink, the more you drink, the less you can cope, so there you are. The, what the book calls the pitiful and incomprehensible state of demoralization that brought us here. Now, as I say, you can have either of these things together, alone, and not be, you're in trouble, but not serious trouble. But if you've got them together, you're in. You're a member, or ought to be, of Alcoholics Anonymous. You have the disease. The scientists are still fussing around with this. In scientific knowledge, to go back to Willard. Right after he got out of the hospital, I should preface that by saying that much of the difficulty in understanding the disease comes from the fact that the men and women of science get so interested in their own specialties that they discount or disregard the other half of the disease. For example, the people who deal with a physical ailment don't recognize the importance of the mental aspect. The people who deal with the mental aspects don't realize the importance of the physical aspect. And if you don't get the whole picture, you don't get any of it. You're more harm than you are good. The mental men do more harm than the physical men, probably. It isn't their fault, it's ours. But you get some guy with 9 degrees after his name, and he comes along, as they do every once in a while. Marty Mann used to say they did it every 6 months. Now they do it every 6 hours. They come along and announce they have a program to teach alcoholics to drink socially. They will say, I will turn your head around so that you will be able to control your drinking, so that you'll be able to be an accomplished gentleman drinker. This I can do because I can make you a different kind of person mentally. Completely ignoring and discounting the physical side. I will say that in my long experience in and around Alcoholics Anonymous, I know many. More reason why you shouldn't deny you're an alcoholic. She said, there are many people who think that Alcoholics Anonymous is a modern chapter in the Book of the Acts. Everybody thinks now that this is a great spiritual program. She said, why do you deny that you're an alcoholic? He said, well, I'm not. This kept up clear across town for an hour, and finally he gave in. He said, okay, lady, I'm an alcoholic. And she says, that's funny, you don't look like an alcoholic. You see, we don't look like alcoholics, we look like human beings. And if somebody, as we are viewed objectively, there's no way to tell whether we're alcoholic or not. It's only as we subjectively identify ourselves as alcoholics that we know what we're talking about. But I can't look at you. In fact, a stranger looking in on this room would wonder what brought this motley group together. There's just no way to explain it except the common denominator of our disease, and that doesn't show. And as you look at an alcoholic objectively, you can't say what kind of trouble he or she's had. We used to think, you know, that you had to be a Skid Row bum or at least a candidate for it. They wouldn't let you in if you had a wristwatch, all of that sort of thing. Nowadays, it doesn't make any difference. We know that objectively viewed, the person's troubles are not apparent. And you may be 9 years old, as some of our alcoholics are now, and have had just as much trouble in your head as the 80-year-old who came in last week who'd had a little more conspicuous trouble. It just doesn't make any difference. And I can't look at you and you can't look at me and say, well, I can't say of you, well, if I hadn't had any more trouble than you've had, I'd still be drinking. And you can't look at me and say, if I'd had all the trouble you had by the time you were 22, I'd have quit long ago. All of these things are unimportant. The important thing is what it is to us in our heads. When our life becomes insupportable, when we would indeed rather die than take a drink, this is when we are aware of the fact that we are alcoholic. Now, as I say, the troubles that we have often help us to identify with each other. I mean, we've been in the same jails, and the same hospitals, married the same women, had all kinds of trouble, But this is unimportant. The important thing is that our trouble stemmed from our drinking, our personal and individual drinking. And so it is when we get well. Our good things, the dividends that occur, are as a result of our not drinking. And they're different for all of us. Some of us get rich in material things. Some of us get rich in spiritual things. Some of us get rich in both. Some of us get rich in neither. Some of us just get a constant growth that, objectively viewed, would say, well, gee, he's worse off now than he was when he was drinking. You know, we know better. But this is why we, in the third distinctive thing between Alcoholics Anonymous and other programs of recovery, have the advantage. We have the counselors, the advisors, the spiritual arm around, the experienced person to talk with and to. This is why those programs that are staffed by recovered alcoholics are successful. I don't know that any others are. There may be. Most of them are fumbling efforts by people who want to get federal money, and that isn't what gets you well in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our sponsors, our people, are good counselors. They're not always nice counselors. They're not always comfortable counselors, but they're right. And if they're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere in the toughness is the tenderness of the sharing. The fourth distinction between AA and other methods of recovery is that we talk our disease to death. Not many diseases yield to this treatment. And this is the only one that I know where we do it. And if you don't think we do it, you should have heard this meeting. You could hear it clear down on the freeway. 15 minutes before it was started, there was going up here, going yakety, 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 yakety. Everybody was talking and nobody was listening. And what we were talking about? We were talking about booze. We were talking about what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like now. We were talking about what happened to poor old Mary. I understand she's back on the Librium again. She's still kidding herself. I understand Joe's back in the hospital. Oh, yeah, but nothing serious, a heart attack. We're obsessed with alcohol and alcoholism and its recovery. And we talk about it. Boy, do we talk about it. Of course, I have the advantage of you now because you can't talk back, and I ought to give you equal time, but it's going to take a little time after we get through. But we talk, and it has a more ulterior motive, really, than talking, because we hear around AA that ours is a program of action. And the reason, really, and it's very subtle, the reason that we're active is that we want to talk about it. We don't listen to anybody around AA very much unless he's talking about his recovery. We've heard all these stories about the terrible things that happened to us before we got here, and we know what's in the steps, but we like to know how it's working for you. What are you doing? Where did you go? Are you on the institutional committee? Are you making 12-step calls? Are you making the coffee? Are you opening up the hall? Are you putting away the ashtrays and chairs? What are you doing? You know, so you got to do something in order to talk about it. My favorite story in this connection is about the old guy that came into the Skid Row meeting down in Los Angeles. He really was a typical Skid Row bum of song and story. He had the long overcoat and the bleeding eyeballs and the twitching hands and the roomy gait, and he came in and sat in the very back row of the Saturday night meeting and resisted all efforts of anybody to say hello to him, and sat there and mumbled to himself and heard only two things: don't drink and come back. And on Sunday night, he came back. And lo and behold, his exact counterpart of the night before came in and sat beside him. The same smelly, long overcoat, bleeding eyeballs, twitching hands. And our friend of Saturday night looked over to our friend of Sunday night and said, "New, eh?" He said, "Let me tell you about me. Yesterday I was just like you, but today I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And in extension, this is what we do. We talk our disease to death. And we talk it because we're obsessed with our recovery just as much as we were obsessed by our... And we talk it because we're obsessed with our recovery just as much as we were obsessed by our disease. At least for me, that's true. I have nothing in my life that's comparable with my sharing of my experience, my strength, and my hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the climate and company of Alcoholics Anonymous, with our fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we do talk about it. And it not only gets us well, it keeps us well, because it gives us, in an irreverent fashion, a spiritual focus that is denied all people everywhere. And this is what I meant when I said that one of the paradoxes of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we so long deny the thing that gets to be the greatest comfort to us. After you've been around a while, or if you have been around a while, you know that we have a feeling in the meaning of Alcoholics Anonymous that we don't have anywhere else. And the reason for that, in large part, is that we are alike here. And the people who are different from us, the 9 out of 10 who don't drink the way we do or aren't compelled to drink the way we were, these people are not here. They're not interested in us. They don't care about us. They don't understand us, but we do. Now, I don't mean to make Alcoholics Anonymous a ghetto, but where we retire from life, but we do know that we have a feeling of ease and comfort here, where the things that are important to us and are not important to anybody else are essential to us, and that the two common denominators of our disease forge a bond of brotherhood among us that's unequaled in any other stratum of society anywhere in history. And that's why we feel as we do, the comfort that we feel here, why we must continue to come to our meetings, to have a renewal of our spiritual refreshment, because we don't get it in that crazy world outside. People can live by the kind of things that they live outside and the kind of things by which we used to live, but would now kill us. So we find this paradox. We deny that we're alcoholic for as long as we can. We insist that we're just like other people. And when at last the horrors of our lives have demonstrated that this is not true, and we give up and say, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm surrounded by alcoholics, at last we know we're at home. Well, that's the third distinctive thing about AA as we talk our disease to death. I guess that's the fourth, isn't it? The fifth and last is that we have a brand new educational approach. You know, most educational approaches are based on what you've learned before you learn what you're next going to learn. You learn the numbers before you learn arithmetic, before you learn algebra, before you learn calculus. You learn French 1 before you learn French 2, this sort of thing. Not so in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are invited, when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to start all over again. Everything we ever held dear, all of the standards and principles by which we lived, forget them. We got to begin over. We got to be new people. We've got to adopt an entirely new philosophy of life. Now, very often the new philosophy of life is that we have in AA is not new at all. It's been known since the beginning of man, really. But when we pretended to live by this, it was only a pretense. Now we are compelled, with what the book calls the open mind of the dying, to look at the kind of life that is led by successfully sober alcoholics, and to do it. Now this is a horrible thing to do, because the hardest thing that a human being can do is to change himself. Most of us are sure now that you can't change yourself under your own power. But this is the hardest thing, and nothing less is required if we're going to get well. We must become a different kind of person. And in order to do that, we must abandon all of the standards and principles by which we lived and become a member of AA. It's extraordinarily difficult. It's probably the hardest thing that a human being can do. And yet it is essential to our recovery. And our book is full of this, too. It says, some of us tried to hang on to our old ideas. and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Half measures availed us nothing. All of these things, meaning that you draw the curtain over what you were and consider an entirely new standard of principles of methods of life and live it in the climate and company of our fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we see it daily demonstrated. Well, these are the five things that sets AA apart from any other method of recovery from our disease. You might say, well, when you've got it all, what have you got? And there really is probably a cop-out to say that you've got the miracle of AA, but in a sense, that's the real explanation of it. It is a miracle in the miraculous sense. A miracle means something that's beyond a human power, that's inexplicable by any reference to human resource. And this is, of course, what happens to most of us. I perhaps speak with more freedom in this area than many people because I'm a fallen away atheist. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I not only didn't believe in God, I didn't believe there was a God, and I thought that anybody who believed in God was an intellectual peasant, far beneath my contempt. Some of these notions seem kind of silly to me now, but I find that they're not unheard of in the newcomer. So I speak freely, and if you're really new, pay no attention. I wouldn't have. But when you get around to appraising what has happened to you, then you may see that, as I did when I appraised what happened to me, because this is the only way I ever understood it. Incidentally, when I began to suggest that it might be nice for me to explain to people what Alcoholics Anonymous was, I ran this by my home group to see whether it was all right to do it at an AA meeting, and they said, oh, yeah, that's all right. They said, it won't hurt anybody. It's got the newcomers will find out what's going to happen to them, and the old-timers will find out what did. And neither of them has to believe you because it just happened to you. So I do it with great comfort. But on this spiritual development, I was a rebellious person. I wasn't one of you namby-pamby agnostics who didn't know what you thought. I knew what I thought, all right. I could demonstrate for hours that there wasn't any God. I was one of these characters that would stand up on the bar, you know, and say, if there's a God, let him strike me down. Nothing happened. I learned later he was doing it by degrees. Anyway, when I came to the program, I was an atheist. And I had been sober over 4 years when I was at last able to say that as an intellectual exercise, there was no explanation for what had happened to me except a superhuman power. You see, I was one of those alcoholics like the Chapter 3 alcoholic who tried everything that he could try, every human resource that I could think of or that I could be persuaded to do or that I could have thrust upon me and compelled to do. Every human resource had been exhausted. And I was still drinking. There was no way that I could do anything about it. And then, as I say, with the open mind of the dying, and I really was, I figured that this was the end. It dawned on me that during the 23 months I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd listened to some of these intellectual peasants that I had been so superior to and arrogant about, that here I was drunk and they were all sober. And they'd all been mouthing about God. And I thought, well, maybe I better take a look. And it was just about as grudgingly as that I did. And that was all that was necessary. I began, instead of actively denying the existence of a higher power, I became willing to grow along spiritual lines. Willing, and that's all. And after my continuous sobriety for over 4 years, I looked back and I said, what have I got? I have something superhuman, because when I was relying upon human resources, I was compelled to drink. When I began to live the AA life with an open mind, I began to get well, and I'm continuing to get well, and therefore if I now have the power to keep from taking a drink, that's a superhuman power, a power beyond any human resource. And so I thought, and so I think. And it made sense then to me when they told me that the second step was the atheist step. That's a step that you don't take. It's one that happens to you. It comes to pass. We came to believe that a power greater than a human power could restore us to sanity and so forth. We came to believe a progress, an unfolding. I get great comfort now in characterizing what happened to all of us in the words of that chapter 5. You remember, we are put at our ease by that statement that says, we are not saints. Boy, I felt right at home. And looking around this room, you did too. We are not saints. And then the very next phrase says, the point is we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The point is of this program that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And so it is. For me, it was difficult. For me, my approach to the understanding of any God and to the changing content of my understanding today was extraordinarily slow, but it has become increasingly comfortable over the years. I had the help, and I'll conclude with a sermon on the behalf of my sponsor, of whom I had the help toward the end of my drinking career. My friend Max was another fallen away atheist. He wasn't very far ahead of me on the program. He and I had been passing each other back and forth in the early days, but he had about, maybe a year ahead of me by this time. And I used to call myself his Japanese wife. I followed respectfully 9 paces behind him. But anyway, he was one of these fellows who knew when to be tough and tender, mostly tough. He was my 9th sponsor. I had worn out several. But anyway, Max gave me some good ideas. Max, for example, said, he said, you got to pray. I said, I don't believe in God. He said, that don't make any difference. I said, do you dislike anybody? Dislike anybody? I said, I hate everybody. He said, do you hate anybody special? Oh, I said, I hate Durward special. He said, well, he said, you got to pray for Durward. Oh, I said, you're crazy. He says, no, you got to pray for Durward. So my first prayer was something like, I said, how do you pray to a God you don't believe in? He said, that's a good address. So my first prayer was, God that I don't believe in. And then I said, how do you pray for somebody like Durward? He said, pray the son of a bitch gets what he deserves. So my first prayers were, God that I don't believe in, give that son of a bitch what he deserves. He says, you'll get over your unbelief, and you will get over calling him names, and you'll get over trying to blueprint what he deserves, and you'll leave that to the God that you come to understand. You know, he was right. Durward went on to great success. I don't know of anybody I prayed for that ever went any farther. But from these seemingly irreverent things, this is the story. This is it. My final word with you and from Max occurred on the last occasion of my drinking when I was driving an automobile under the influence of alcohol. I didn't know any other way to drive. And I hit a truck on the grapevine down here, one of those great big things with Christmas tree lights all over it that you can't see. And I was badly wounded. I cracked the kneecap, among other things. And incidentally, I'm covered with scars. They're all in front. I was a courageous drunk. But on this occasion, I cracked my kneecap, and it took me a long time to convalesce. And after I got home from the hospital and was lying on my bed of pain over in Ventura, Max would do all kinds of things for me. My wife didn't drive in those days. Max would go down to the post office and get the mail and go to the office and open up and check things out and come home and take the kids to school in the car and do the family marketing. And then in the afternoon, if he had a chance, he'd come up and visit the sick. And one day when he was up visiting me, he said, I said to him, Max, I said, why do you do all these things for me? You're almost a saint. And I thought he was going to say, well, you're such a fine fellow that if we ever get you sober, you'll be a credit to Alcoholics Anonymous. But he didn't say that. He said, I'm glad you asked. He said, I want to tell you why I do all these things for you. It isn't because I like you, you son of a bitch. He says, I wish you were dead. I said, Max. He said, no. He said, everybody I know wishes you were dead. He said, you know, I suffer from an incurable, progressive, terminal disease that doesn't yield to any human power. And in order to have a superhuman power to treat my disease, I am compelled, against my will and however reluctantly, to love and serve my fellows without any thought of personal reward and at some personal sacrifice. And he said, I can't think of anything that causes me more personal sacrifice and offers less chance of personal reward than loving and serving you. Now that's it, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Dr. Bob said, let's not louse it up, let's keep it simple. Let's remember that it's a program of love and of service. We have a special gift, you and me, as alcoholics. We have a special gift in loving and serving other alcoholics. But it doesn't stop there, nor does it begin there. If we are to treat our disease, we are compelled, however reluctantly at first, however rebelliously, and without any thought of personal reward except our sobriety in the offing, to love and serve. And it's a complete reversal of what we were. And it must be. We must be that kind of a person. Instead of the selfish, egocentric, self-will, me first, poor me, give me, that we were, we must be the kind of person who gives. If we really have a patron saint, it's probably St. Francis of Assisi. And you'll remember the last words of his most famous prayer. And this, of course, is what we come in our seeking our conscious contact by seeking only knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. Come to realize that in the words of this prayer, grant that I may seek to comfort rather than to be comforted. To understand rather than to be understood. To love rather than to be loved. And this is it. Now, it's nice for you to love me, but that's not essential to my life. The important thing for me is to love you, because that gives me the contact with the God that I have come to understand, who's here tonight in every sober alcoholic. Who's here tonight to the point where I can feel you. And if you don't yet be my guest, my God is yours. And I invite his blessing on every one of you.